Age of Treason Radio. With your host, Tan Stoffel. Anti-racism is a Jewish construct. In my podcasts, I focus on the same approach that I take to the articles that I write, which is to try and simplify subjects that are complex. And I try to boil it down to what is really the most important points and then make that available to other people, first for my own benefit, but then also to benefit other people who are trying to understand these things as well. One of the things that just about everyone is confronted with is this aphorism that's very popular today. It's actually the opposite of an aphorism being a short expression of wisdom, a short phrase that expresses a certain wisdom. This is a sort of anti-wisdom. The idea that race is a social construct, which is the core idea behind anti-racism. The reality, the true aphorism, is that society is a racial construct, that race is real and it's biological, and that society springs from that biological reality of race. The interesting thing about the Jews is that they've flip-flopped on race. The Jews were for race before they were against it. It reminds me of the old Jewish saying that two Jews, three opinions. And I've made the point many times that, yeah, two Jews, three opinions about what's best for the Jews. So it's really one monolithic opinion that they have underneath it all. Jews change their arguments 180 degrees, if that's what suits them, from one day to the next, from one argument to the next, from one sentence to the next. They will make their argument based on what they think is best for the Jews. Franz Boas is a good example of this. I've talked about Franz Boas a lot, but I talked about him most recently in Race and Jews Part 6 back in November of last year, when I referred to a book by Eric Goldstein, a Jew who was trying to explain Jewish attitudes toward race in America in the early part of the 20th century. He wrote a book that was titled The Price of Whiteness, Jews, Race, and American Identity. And what I wrote about it at the time, what I described in my podcast at the time, is that Goldstein described the private communications between Jewish leaders in America. In 1909, these leaders feared that race scientists were close to declaring the Jews to be a non-white race. And so they conspired to enlist the help of an anthropologist in order to get a, quote, very strongly worded declaration as to the practical identity of the white race, unquote, one that would presumably leave no doubt as to the whiteness of Jews. This was in the first decade of the 20th century, 1909. Furthermore, Goldstein writes about this, during the first two decades of the 20th century, Columbia University professor Franz Boas was the best-known anthropologist of Jewish origin in the United States. Boas shared the concern of the Jewish communal elite about racial nativism, but his preference to identify as a German-American rather than as a Jew prevented him from engaging too directly in Jewish defense efforts during these years. Instead, Boas worked to discredit the centrality of race in evaluating human capabilities, arguing that differences between groups, including those between blacks and whites, were heavily influenced by environmental factors. Because these ideas contradicted the overwhelming consensus about the importance of racial differences in the United States, however, they offered little to Jewish leaders hoping to win acceptance for their group in white America. The other Jewish scientist that these Jewish leaders enlisted at the time was Maurice Fishberg, who took a slightly different approach. In a book published in 1911, Fishberg argued that the Jews were not a, quote, race, creed, or nation, unquote, but simply a, quote, social phenomena, unquote. And that didn't go over very well with the Jews, either the leaders of the Jews or the Jews in general. the reception was very cold to this because they identified as a race, as a people. And Goldstein tried to describe this apparent conflict by writing, "If Jews found that race was an increasing liability and threatened to lump them with non-whites, they also found themselves unable to break the emotional commitment they had to a racial self-understanding. The result was a constant struggle with these two powerful impulses for inclusion and distinctiveness, one that led many acculturated Jews to assert their status as a religious group in public while privately clinging to a much broader racial understanding of their Jewishness." In other words, they had both. They denied race in public, and they understood that they were a race in private among themselves. My assessment of this is that these two powerful impulses for inclusion and distinctiveness, these two mindsets, there is no real conflict between them. They're exactly what a parasitic organism needs to succeed in order to be able to infiltrate, manipulate, and exploit its host. It needs to detect and disarm the host's defenses while being mindful enough of its own identity not to attack or destroy itself. And we see this in the dance that the Jews have done with race just in the last 100 years. Now, I've done a lot of work prior to this that this is really an extension of and a part of. This podcast here is going to focus on some new information that I think will interest anyone who was interested in this previous work I've done. I did a 5-part series on race science soon after I began podcasting called Race and Genetics. I followed that with a 5-part series on race and anthropology, the understanding of the early science of genetics led directly to this struggle in anthropology that we're going to talk about in some detail this time. After that, I zoomed in even closer and did a 6 installments focused on Boas and his protégés, the people that he taught who carried on the anti-racist struggle after his death, and specifically focused on Ruth Benedict and Jean Weltfish and their propaganda of the races of mankind in a 4-part series. This time I'd like to fast forward to today, to right now, last month, in fact, in April. An anthropologist, a physical anthropologist named Peter Frost. He studies the evolutionary genetic nature of the most visibly obvious racial attributes of whites, skin and hair. And here's how he describes himself. He writes, "My own research has focused on the sex difference in human complexion. In short, women are paler and men ruddier and browner because of differing amounts of hemoglobin and melanin in the skin's outer layers. This subject has also led me to the puzzle of European pigmentation, i.e. the highly visible facial and body hues that occur almost wholly in Europeans. How can we explain the wide range of hair colors, the equally wide range of eye colors, and the maximum lightening of the skin? These color traits are a puzzle, all the more so because they do not have a single genetic cause." He's written articles with titles such as "Why Do Europeans Have So Many Hair and Eye Colors?" and another one titled "Why Are Europeans So White?" These are the sorts of things that white racialists like myself are very much interested in. And these are short articles that are fairly easy to read. Frost is a favorite in what's called human biodiversity. I don't know if he's ever identified himself as a believer in that, but he is someone who other people who identify as part of the HBD-osphere really like. And he blogs at unz.com, the website run by the Jew Ron Unz, who is, I could say a whole lot about him, but let's just suffice to say that he's an anti-white Jew. And he hosts lots of these HBD, human biodiversity type bloggers. The writers and the commenters at that site, including at Frost's site, you see there's a large number of Jews, but also plenty of part Jews and other people who like Jews, Jew firsters, Jew worshipers. And the odd thing about that is that these people are on the fringe. They're outside of the mainstream where the reality of race is not accepted, and race is a social construct, as I say. Anti-racism prevails. And at unst.com and amongst these HBD writers and commenters, the idea that race is real is generally accepted, but what they reject is the idea that Jews are racially distinct. Although occasionally they will even admit that, but what's really glaring about the difference between them and, say, a white nationalist or a white racialist, somebody who really accepts the reality of race in a deep sense, is that they try to gloss over the differences between whites and Jews, and specifically the hostility that Jews have for whites. They make explanations trying to explain that away. And that's partly why Frost comes up here, because that's what he's been trying to do lately. In an article that he titled, "The Franz Boas You Never Knew," Frost argues that early in his career, Boas believed that race differences were real, significant, and rooted in biology. And I'm just going to read a few excerpts from his article. He provides some quotes and makes his other arguments, but basically this is one of the key points. Something critical seems to have happened in the late 1930s when Boas prepared the second edition of his text, The Mind of Primitive Man, published in 1938 or republished in 1938. He removed his earlier racialist statements. The reason was likely geopolitical. As a Jewish American seeing the rise of Nazi Germany, he may have felt that the fight against anti-Semitism would require a united front against all forms of, quote, racism, unquote, a word just starting to enter common use and initially a synonym for Nazism. Boas died in 1942, and the leadership of his school of anthropology fell to Ruth Benedict and Margaret Mead. With the end of the war, both of them wished to pursue and even escalate the fight against racism. A few interesting things here to note. Racism is a synonym for Nazism, or it was originally, that was the origin in his mind for it. In other words, anti-racism is anti-Nazism. Unfortunately for this narrative that Frost is trying to create here, Boas was hard at work against race science long before 1933 and the rise of the National Socialists in Germany. As early as 1909, the Jewish leaders saw race science as a problem for the Jews, as bad for the Jews, and they were looking for a way to co-opt it, to undermine it, or at least to get Jews classified as white so that they wouldn't be kicked out of the United States. And they won that battle, and they won by attacking and winning on multiple fronts. Today, the aphorism, or the poisonous reverse aphorism, that race is a social construct prevails in the mainstream. Today, also, there is no such thing as the white race. It's a social construct. It's imaginary. And yet, today, the idea that Jews aren't white is considered scandalous, even amongst these HBD race realists. Frost, for instance, I think, considers Jews white because of how they look. And that's usually the trick that's involved in these people's minds is they just say, you know, even though they're specialists in race and how deep race goes down to the genes, when it comes to the Jews, well, Jews look white, and so therefore they're white. That's how shallow their understanding of race suddenly becomes when it's about the Jews. Frost's conclusion to his article about Boas was, Boas had sought to strike a new balance between nature and nurture in the study of man. The war intervened, however, and Boasian anthropology was conscripted to fight not only the Axis, but also racism in any form. Today, three quarters of a century later, we're still fighting that war. It's actually Frost who's seeking to strike a new balance. The current thoroughly Judaized anti-white regime sees Boas as a hero, as a champion of what eventually became full-blown anti-racism, although it wasn't called anti-racism in Boas's day. dissidents, the pro-white Jew-wise opponents of the Judaizer regime, properly finger Boas as an enemy and a villain, the earliest, most prominent, and most prolific proponent of what eventually became anti-racism. So on the point of whether of Boas's importance to anti-racism, both sides agree there. The Jews and the anti-Jews, the anti-whites and the whites, that Boas was significant in what eventually became anti-racism. It's Frost who's trying to argue something different on that specific point. He's trying to argue that Boas is actually somewhere in the middle. Just a guy trying to strike a balance who only sided with his own race when he was forced to, when he was pushed into it by the evil Nazis. In fact, Frost takes that argument a step farther by trying to argue that the Jews, as a group, are not responsible for anti-racism. In other words, he's excusing the Jews. And I think Frost is white. I think that. I don't know for sure whether he's white or Jewish, part Jewish, or married to a Jewish woman. I really don't know. What I do know is that when I read his arguments, he seems to think more like a white man than like a Jew. He is objective. He's scientific. He tries to be. And he doesn't get emotional when talking about the Jews, as a Jew does. Now, the strange thing is that he identifies this struggle between whites and Jews as a war. And he's actually engaged in it. He's a soldier in the ongoing battle over the idea of race and whether race is rooted in biology. And he's on the side of biology. He's on the side of science. He's a professional scientist, a professional race scientist. But he doesn't seem to want to take it seriously as a war. And he doesn't seem to want to side with his own team. He's not against the aggressors. He can't even really clearly identify them. Instead, he sees their identity. He sees that they identify with their own kind and they have concern for that. But he doesn't feel his own identity. He doesn't feel for his own people and want to side with them against these aggressors, and instead is trying to make an argument in their defense that it isn't really a struggle between whites and Jews, that anti-racism isn't really anti-white, I guess. I don't think he's gone that far, but that seems to be the nonsensical conclusion that he's driving toward. He followed up the first article with a second, and this is where we come to another person whose opinion I'm going to talk about a little bit here, and that is the pseudonymous blogger N/A, or just N-A, which I'm not sure what that stands for, but it's the symbol that you would use to write not applicable, to abbreviate not applicable, N/A. And his blog is titled Race History Evolution Notes. And I've been following that blog and that blogger for a long time. He has a very deep understanding of race, and all aspects of it, the genetics of it, the history of it, and the Jewish involvement in it. I think he's a he. I think he's an American. He's a logical thinker, probably a scientist professionally of some sort. And it's clear that he identifies very strongly with WASPs, quote-unquote WASPs, to the point that he recognizes and dislikes that term because he sees that it's an enemy slur, in much the same way that National Socialists dislike the word Nazi. N.A. often takes issue with someone like Frost who misunderstands or misrepresents history, especially regarding WASPs, America's founding stock, and especially when it involves the Jews. Long time ago, N.A. nailed neo-reaction, also known as Judeo-reaction, before it even adopted that name, when he summed up Mencius Moldbug by describing him as wanting to bring back monarchy so I can live out my dream of becoming a court Jew. That's N.A.'s deep understanding of European history and the Jewish involvement in it showing there. Now, Frost made a comment in his exchange with people that were commenting on his first article about Boas spelling out what he was trying to do, the how he was trying to excuse the Jews. And N.A. saw that and wrote a blog post in response. He titled "Reply to Peter Frost's Most Recent Bizarre Attempt at Rewriting History, Part 1. Peter Frost has previously claimed in a comment to this article that I've already talked about of Frost. Frost wrote, "Anti-racism was neither solely nor primarily a Jewish invention. It initially arose through the radicalization of the abolitionist movement in the early to mid-19th century, its adherents being overwhelmingly of WASP origin. It then fell into decline, largely in response to the failure of black emancipation and the growing influence of Darwinian thinking in the social sciences. It was this half-discredited anti-racism that Jewish immigrants, like Franz Boas, encountered in the late 19th century and the early 20th. With the rise of Nazi Germany, anti-racism made a resurgence, and Jewish intellectuals certainly contributed to this resurgence for obvious reasons. But it was at all times as much a Northeastern WASP cultural trait as a Jewish one." End of quote of Peter Frost's comment. So N.A. wrote about this, he said, he's now back with more of this, and he links to Frost's second article trying to expand on the topic titled "More on the Younger Franz Boas," where Frost writes, "How did Franz Boas's views on race evolve over the next 20 years? This evolution is described by Williams in 1996, who sees his views beginning to change at the turn of the century. After getting tenure at Columbia University in 1899, he became immersed in the elite liberal culture of the American Northeast and began to express his views on race accordingly. From 1900 to 1930, Boas seemed to become increasingly liberal in his views on race, but this trend was hesitant at best and reflected, at least in part, a change in the audience he was addressing. As a professor at Columbia, he was dealing with a regional WASP culture that still preserved the radical abolitionism of the previous century. A good example was Mary White Ovington, whose Unitarian parents had been involved in the anti-slavery movement and who in 1910 helped found the NAACP. Boas was also dealing with the city's growing African-American community, and though Ovington's contacts, and through Ovington's contacts, wrote articles for the NAACP. Finally, he was also dealing with the growing Jewish community, who identified with anti-racism partly out of self-interest and partly out of a desire to assimilate into Northeastern WASP culture." N.A. responds to this by writing, "It's an outrageous distortion of history to suggest Jews supported anti-racism, quote, out of a desire to assimilate into Northeastern WASP culture," unquote. He continues, "Most Northeasterners of any class were never abolitionists, and anti-slavery does not equal abolitionist. And even most abolitionists did not advocate anything approaching modern anti-racism. No major constituency in America denied the existence of biological differences between blacks and whites when Boas immigrated, and advocating such views provided no quick path to social advancement, though obviously at a deeper level, Boas was no doubt motivated by a desire to eliminate, quote, anti-Semitism, unquote. It would have been very strange indeed for a physical anthropologist in 1890s America to outright deny the existence of race or obvious racial differences. What matters is the direction in which Boas differed from his contemporaries, and there's no question Boas was promoting, quote, anti-racism, unquote, from the outset." Now, I like N.A.'s use of sneer quotes around the enemy's propaganda terms. It shows that he is aware that they're propaganda terms and that he has disdain for them. Now, N.A. went on to write four other parts, I believe it was a five-part series of fairly short blog posts, and I'm just reading excerpts from them here, and that's all I'm going to focus on is some of the parts that I thought were most interesting. I'd encourage you, this is one of those blog podcasts where the information behind what I'm talking about here is actually a lot deeper, and you would probably benefit from coming to look at the podcast post and follow some of these links and read some of these arguments yourself, read the deeper context if you have time. In part two, N.A. wrote, the title that he gave it was of his part two was Boas was a product of German Jewish culture, not American culture. The version of history in which Franz Boas was a dispassionate purveyor of real talk who picked up anti-racism from, quote, liberal wasps, unquote, is of course wholly Peter Frost's own invention. This scenario finds no support outside of Frost's imagination. Boas's agenda remained consistent over his entire career, and it's not an agenda he picked up in America. Boas was born in Germany, studied anthropology in Germany, brought his fully formed worldview with him from Germany, and continued to identify with Germany throughout his life. Nor was it, quote, liberal wasps, unquote, Boas primarily affiliated himself with in America. And this article, NA links and excerpts from an academic anthropology paper from 1982 titled Types Distinct from Our Own, Franz Boas on Jewish Identity and Assimilation. It's a long, very interesting paper, about 20 pages, 20 printed pages. The synopsis, though, reads at the very beginning, Boas's published writings on assimilation were deeply influenced by his German-Jewish background, in particular his unwillingness to recognize Jewish cultural identity as a reality was central to his persistent emphasis on human plasticity and his insistence that people not be classified in groups. In other words, anti-racism, and we see here the double think behind it, that it was his strong Jewish identity and his strong background as a Jew, his heritage as a Jew, that compelled him to deny it in the open, in public at least, and to come up in particular with these scientific explanations as to why race was not so important and it was very plastic, that it the famous study that he's known for is one of many is a study of immigrant skull dimensions and how they changed in one generation miraculously to match American norms, even when they were very different when they first arrived. And it turns out that those differences were a fabrication, really, that the data that he had collected was reevaluated decades later in the early 2000s, if I remember correctly. And they were found to be no statistically significant changes in the skull measurements from one generation of immigrants to the next, to their children, once they were in America. So his claims were bogus. They were fraudulent. A little further, still on the first page, I think, of this anthropology paper, they write, Boas's work is marked with the deepest irony in that his position on these questions was shaped far more deeply, it would seem, than he recognized by his own heritage as a German Jew and by formative years, which coincided precisely with an eruption of the most explicit and virulent anti-Semitism in Germany prior to Hitler. And that's one reason why this paper, even though it's written by a Jew named Glick, is an interesting paper, because it talks about a period of time that I don't think most people, certainly not most white people, but even most racialists are not familiar with. I'm not all that familiar with it myself, and that is the years in the second half of the 19th century and the political situation in post-emancipation Germany, after the Jews had been emancipated and were considered equal citizens with the native Germans, and the revolutions of the mid part of the century there, and the political upheaval that really gripped Germany for a long time there and shaped many people's lives. The point I think to make about that, though, is that the Jews were emancipated before the Negroes were emancipated, and that the people like Frost, who like to talk about how there were white abolitionists who were behind the emancipation of the Negro and were anti-racist, often neglect to make that connection, that at the same time and actually prior to the agitation of the abolitionists for the emancipation of Negroes, there was the movement that was no doubt influenced by Jews to the extent they could influence it to emancipate the Jews first. So the thinking behind both was similar, and it was similarly disastrous for Europeans. Both types of emancipation and all the emancipations that followed afterwards. the emancipation of women and the emancipation of immigrants and migrants, refugees, so that they could just cross borders that previously had been closed to them, for instance, that we've talked about in the last couple of podcasts. In part three, N.A. focuses on the founding of the NAACP. I don't have any particular interest in that, but I think he notes that it was, besides the woman that Frost mentions, the white woman, there was also a Jew involved and somebody else who was married to a Jew. That's worthy of a whole podcast to itself, to examine the origins of the NAACP. In part four, N.A. titled it Grant versus Boas. And this is where we cross again into terrain that I'm very familiar with. I've done my own work in this. But N.A. quotes from a book written by Jonathan Spiro, who may be a Jew, I don't recall exactly, but it was about Madison Grant, and the title of the book was Defending the Master Race, Conservation, Eugenics, and the Legacy of Madison Grant. Spiro writes, "If, as we delve into these complicated and long-forgotten controversies, the issues sometimes seem arcane, if not downright petty, it will be good to bear in mind that, like the Cold War battles over Quemoy and Matsu, a great deal more was at stake than met the eye. The lives of millions of persons depended on the struggle over the validity of scientific racism." I'll interject there to point out, yeah, the struggle, what Peter Frost calls a war. What is a war, really? A one-sided Jewish war against whites, and the validity of race science. Scientific racism, the fact that Spiro calls it scientific racism, is an after-the-fact name for it, for race science. It's what the victors of that war have decided to call it, scientific racism, because they're anti-racists. And so that's how they describe what all of these eminent, very intelligent men, these polymaths that were behind race science up until about Boas's time, unchallenged really, are today called scientific racists. Spiro continues, and this is N.A. of excerpting from Spiro to make his point about Grant versus Boas. Spiro writes, "For years, however, Boas has been diligently training a cadre of professional anthropologists who shared his revulsion for the theories of Grant, so that by the end of the 1910s, Boas was surrounded and supported by a growing group of scholars well-positioned to use their expertise to join in the assault on eugenics. Some of the more important anthropologists who received their PhD from Boas were A.L. Kroeber, who earned his degree in 1901, Robert Lowy, 1908, Edward Sapper, 1909, Alexander Goldenweiser, 1910, Paul Radin, 1911, Leslie Speer, 1920, Ruth Benedict, 1923, Melville Herskovitz, 1923, Margaret Mead, 1929, and Ashley Montague, 1937. With the exception of Kroeber, Benedict, and Mead, all were Jews. Many were immigrants, and several were both. It was a poorly kept secret that Ashley Montague, the son of a Polish-born Jewish tailor, had been Moses Israel Ehrenberg before metamorphosing into Montague Francis Ashley Montague. It's the name game, the Jewish name game going on there. But also what N.A. is trying to demonstrate here is that Boas was engaged in this war long before 1933, long before the 1920s, and in fact in the first decade of the 20th century was already beginning to build this cadre of fellow tribe members and others that would go along to get along with his fight. Spiro continues, "On the theoretical level, the debate between the Grantians and the Boasians pitted the defenders of heredity against the proponents of environment. Intellectually, the split was a disagreement between adherents of polygenesis, who were obsessed with the classification of races, and adherents of monogenesis, who were fairly certain that races were socially constructed myths. And professionally, it was a conflict between an older generation of physical anthropologists, often gentlemen amateurs, with no academic affiliation or perhaps an association with a museum, and the newer generation of cultural anthropologists, usually trained professionals with full-time positions in academia. But for all that, it was difficult not to notice that at heart it was a confrontation between the ethos of native Protestants and the zeitgeist of immigrant Jews. The older generation of amateurs were aristocratic wasps with the money and leisure time to ponder fossils as an avocation, whereas the younger generation of professionals were immigrant Jews who saw higher education as a route to social respectability and jobs in academia as a means of economic survival. So according to Spiro, it was difficult not to notice the conflict between white racialists and Jewish anti-racists, contradicting Frost's narrative about what happened in the early 20th century, that it was a conflict between whites and Jews. A side note here that really doesn't have anything to do with the debate, but I found it odd that Spiro used the words polygenesis and monogenesis and identified that as a key difference. What those terms mean is polygenesis is a very deep idea of race, that race is not only biological, but that it's very deeply biological. It goes back a long time and it's very significant. It's the idea that continental races evolved separately and crossed the threshold to becoming human, to being capable of creating art and culture and civilization separately. That each of the three major races, the black, white, and yellow races, all were separate as groups before they became human, and then they became human independently. Whereas monogenesis is what is today called the out of Africa theory, the idea that based on this poisonous aphorism that we're all one race, the human race. In part five, N.A. discusses an anthropology book, some excerpts from an anthropology book that was published in 2004, which actually argues for the biological reality of race, the side that Peter Frost should be on, but appears not to be. And N.A. titled this part five, Anthropology as the Science of Race. In discussing the history of anthropology, Sarich and Miele, in Race, the Reality of Human Differences, that's the text from 2004, find it useful to, quote, highlight three critical junctures in which science, politics, and personality interacted. The disputes between Ernst Haeckel and Rudolf Virchow, between Franz Boas and Madison Grant, and finally between Carlton Kuhn and Ashley Montague, unquote. N.A. writes, of the two cases that played out in America, both involve race denialist Jewish immigrants opposing, quote, Northeastern wasps, unquote, with colonial roots. Kuhn's ancestry is three-quarter colonial New England and one-quarter Cornish. All of Grant's ancestors were in America before 1790, and at least half of Grant's ancestry can be traced back to New England. Skipping a bit here, again quoting from this text that N.A. is excerpting. Haeckel, who, by the way, I discussed a bit in Race and Genetics, the multi-part series I did on Race and Genetics, Haeckel is one of the giants in that history. Haeckel, who was a German scientist, by the way, and all he came to champion were opposed by his former professor, the distinguished biologist Rudolf Virchow. The conflict between them was both personal and political. Virchow, whose name and appearance betrayed a Slavic ancestry. Virchow was ethnically Slavic, apparently, and that's probably part of the reason for their difference. But Haeckel was a strong supporter of the German Volk and Reich. Virchow was a radical advocate of social reform who fought at the barricades in the Revolution of 1848, and that would be when the Jews were finally and totally emancipated in Germany. And in fact, Wilhelm Marr, who popularized the term anti-Semitism in the 1870s, wrote about that period of time that the Jews already had conquered Germany at that point. They already owned the banks and had their claws into the – they already ran the country. Basically, they'd already conquered Germany by that point. Eugenics is applied race science, really. It's the idea of using race science to guide politics, to help government decide what the policies should be. Quoting again from this textbook that NA is excerpting, when Galton died in 1911, eugenics was widely accepted not only in Britain and Germany, but in the United States as well. Raymond Pearl, professor of biology at Johns Hopkins University, then a supporter of eugenics but later an opponent, noted that by 1912, eugenics was catching on to an extraordinary degree with radical and conservative alike. At the start of the 20th century, most American anthropologists came from wealthy Brahmin families who were educated at Harvard University. They were solidly in the eugenics camp, agreeing with Francis Galton on both individual and race differences. And then, as one author put it, along came Boas. His name is hardly a household word, but it is no exaggeration to say that Franz Boas remade American anthropology in his own image. Through the works of his students Margaret Mead, Coming of Age in Samoa and Sex and Temperament in Three Societies, Ruth Benedict, Patterns of Culture, and Ashley Montague, innumerable titles, especially the countless editions of Man's Most Dangerous Myth, Boas would have more effect on American intellectual thought than Darwin did. For generations, hardly anyone graduated from an American college or university without having read at least one of these books. They all drew their inspiration from Boas's The Mind of Primitive Man. Before Boas, anthropology was the study of race. After Boas, anthropology in America became the study of culture. And that's the difference, by the way, between physical anthropology, or which is basically the continuation of race science, and what dominates in anthropology today, which is called cultural anthropology. That is a result of Boas's war on physical anthropology. More from this textbook. Franz Boas was a dark-haired Jewish immigrant from a leftist milieu, educated at German university, steeped in the ideals of the Enlightenment. Madison Grant, an archetypal Nordic, was a lawyer turned amateur biologist and a pillar of American WASP establishment. Grant claimed that his fellow American Nordics were committing racial suicide, allowing themselves to be, quote, elbowed out, unquote, of their own land by ruthless, self-interested Jewish immigrants who were behind the campaign to discredit racial research. Skipping ahead a bit, N.A. now cites a section having to do with Kuhn and Montague. Well, by the way, that last sentence that I just read makes it sound as if this is some sort of conspiracy theory. Actually, a very convincing case can and has been made by many people. I'm really just sort of marshalling the facts and gathering together several of these arguments in one place. And this is the point that Peter Frost is trying to deny, that it was these self-interested Jewish immigrants. He actually doesn't deny that part, but that they were the ones who were behind the campaign to discredit racial research. Frost tries to argue against that. So N.A. moves on here to Kuhn versus Montague, again quoting from this same 2004 textbook. The Boasians were outsiders. Papa Franz, which is Boas's nickname by what his students, many of his students called him, and many of his students were Jews. Though the preponderance of Jewish intellectuals in the early years of Boasian anthropology and the Jewish identities of anthropologists in subsequent generations has been downplayed in standard histories of the discipline. Some, like Boas himself, were immigrants to boot. Montague was born Israel Ehrenberg in the working class East End district of London, England. He was so leery of antisemitism, quote, if you were brought up as a Jew, you know that all non-Jews are antisemitic. It's a good working hypothesis, unquote, that he reinvented himself as Montague Francis Ashley Montague from London's well-to-do West End financial district, complete with a posh public school accent. When he came to the United States, Montague played the role of the British headmaster, lecturing American audiences before a receptive media on the foolishness of their prejudices. Later, he dropped the hyphen and became simply Ashley Montague. Mead and Benedict could point to WASP pedigrees as pure as Madison Grant's, but Mead was bisexual and Benedict was a lesbian. At the time, those sexual orientations were far more stigmatized than they are today. Their sexual preferences were relevant because developing a critique of traditional American values was as much a part of the Boasian program in anthropology as was their attack on eugenics and nativism. Whatever their individual origin, the Boasians felt deeply estranged from mainstream American society and the male WASP elites they were displacing in anthropology. So this is to Peter Frost's point that it wasn't solely the Jews that were behind anti-racism. No, there were WASPs like Mead and Ruth Benedict that were involved with Boaz and the other Jews that were behind this drive for anti-racism. But the point is that they too were estranged for similar reasons. They saw themselves as a minority, much like the Jews do, and were hostile to the prevailing majority, the normal society. Skipping a bit ahead in this text, according to Degler, quote, Boas almost single-handedly developed in America the concept of culture, which, like a powerful solvent, would in time expunge race from the literature of social science, unquote. In fact, Boas achieved his goal only with help, including a great deal from a most unwelcome source, Hitler and the Holocaust. After World War II, race and eugenics became very dirty words. In 1949, the United Nations Educational, Social, and Cultural Organization, UNESCO, was called upon to adopt a, quote, a program of disseminating scientific facts designed to remove what is generally known as racial prejudice, unquote. For the drafter of the first UNESCO statement, Ashley Montague, this was an opportunity to deny the reality of race. That's why Ashley Montague is important, is because he had that key role as the drafter of that first UNESCO statement. And it's very much in line with the work that Ruth Benedict and Gene Weltfish did in The Races of Mankind, in that it used scientific arguments, the trappings of science, of objectivity and authority, the authority that science had earned by that point, and used it to deny the reality of race, the biological significance of race. It was a fraud, in other words. Skipping ahead to a section titled Ashley Montague versus Carlton Kuhn. The preliminary match in anthropology's fight over race was Virchow versus Hegel. Then there was Boas versus Madison Grant. The final match in anthropology's dispute went the distance. Carlton Stevens Kuhn believed that race was a central issue, and his job as an anthropologist was to study race. Montague felt his was to banish race to the periphery and replace it with the concept of, quote, ethnic group, unquote. He began his effort to have the word, quote, race, unquote, replaced by, quote, ethnic group, unquote, in his 1942 book, Man's Most Dangerous Myth, The Fallacy of Race. When he was selected to draft the initial 1950 UNESCO statement on race, Montague was given a platform from which to present his view to a much larger non-academic audience. There's much more from that textbook that NA quotes. I'm just quoting some excerpts here, and I'm pretty much done with talking about NA's five-part rebuttal to Peter Frost. There's much more to say about Carlton Kuhn. He really is another one of these polymaths, and his magnum opus was the physical anthropology textbook titled The Origin of Races, published in 1962. So there were still white physical anthropologists trying to do race science even into the 1960s. And there still are today, really, but they are vastly outnumbered by the anti-racists, the cultural anthropologists. Carlton Kuhn was a proponent of polygenesis, by the way, the deep biological race theory. Now, Frost, I want to call attention that this is something that N.A. doesn't do because he's not really all that interested in National Socialism or defending National Socialism as he is in defending WASPs. But what I noticed was another thing in Frost's – he wrote three separate articles in the end so far trying to push this line that Franz Boas was actually a race realist, not an anti-racist, and that the Jews are not the were not the primary force behind anti-racism. And the point that N.A. doesn't mention that Frost makes over and over again is that racism equals Nazism, that racism, the term, was considered synonymous with Nazism initially. In his most recent article, which he titled Age of Reason, Frost writes, "The interwar years have gave anti-racism a new lease on life, thus reversing a long decline that had begun in the late 19th century. This reversal was driven largely by two events, the acrimonious debate over U.S. immigration in the mid-1920s and Hitler's rise to power in the early 1930s. Many people, especially academics, were convinced of the need for an uncompromising war on, quote, racism, unquote, a word just entering use as a synonym for Nazism." Now, this, you may notice, is a modification of the initial thesis that he put forth, which is that Boas was not an anti-racist at all, was a race realist until the 1930s when the Nazis arose, and then he sided with his own tribe against the Nazi menace. And here, probably due to some criticism, although he doesn't seem to have seen N.A.'s criticism, or at least taken it to heart, he has added this acrimonious debate over U.S. immigration in the mid-1920s. What he doesn't still address is the fact that even before that debate, the Jews were trying to undermine race science in as early as 1909, according to that book about the price of whiteness that I cited at the very beginning of this podcast. Another point about this theme that Frost seems hung up on, this idea that racism equals Nazism, is he's undermining his own case, really, when he makes that point, because that implies that anti-racism is anti-Nazism, or at least started off as anti-Nazism. In other words, that it's something that was pushed primarily by Jews. The word Nazi is a slur. Even now, 70 years after the quote-unquote Nazis were defeated. And it's a slur, even now, 7 decades later, exactly because the Jews won that war and now more or less openly dominate Western culture and dictate our morality. They promote their narrative through education and the mass media. You can see for yourself the mantra over and over again. Whenever racism is mentioned, so is antisemitism, usually together, racism and antisemitism, as in combating racism and antisemitism. This is what the current regime is obsessed with. They are obsessed with fighting racism, being anti-racist, and being anti-antisemitic. Frost called it a war, and it is a war. And in fact, the other side recognizes that when they call it combating racism and combating antisemitism. And they wage it openly via conferences, meetings, laws that they pass against these things, and dedicated departments of the various governments that are their mission is to combat racism and antisemitism. And on the other side are people like Peter Frost, who won't even take his own side, won't even take the side of his own people against this aggressor. In Race and the Jews, Part 7, I summed up, I think, the real narrative, what really happened from a white point of view. And I'll just read what I wrote at the time. During the 19th century and into the 20th, whites were just beginning to appreciate the depth and breadth of their roots, their biological relationship with each other, but also to recognize their common parasite. They were beginning to appreciate just how biologically and psychologically distinct and implacably alien and hostile the Jews are and have always been, how the Jews have in fact insisted upon being and remaining this way. This growing understanding of their roots, this racial consciousness, was not fabricated out of nothing, but was based on evidence gathered from study and research, archaeology, linguistics, biology. It was spreading not only among the elite, the intelligentsia, but was beginning to trickle out to the masses too. In the first half of the 20th century, Madison Grant's Passing of the Great Race and Lothrop Stoddard's Rising Tide of Color were popular books. White understanding of race was increasing. In 1933, the National Socialists took power in Germany, and for the first time, a white European government officially and definitively answered the question, "Who is us?" and pursued policies guided by the principle, "What's best for us, racially?" Expressing a collective group consciousness that for the first time approximated and took into account the competitive and adversarial nature of the kind of collective awareness and identity and interest that the Jews had been practicing for millennia among and against Europeans. Even before this racial consciousness had fully coalesced into a National Socialist government, those Jews most aware of their collective interests recognized this burgeoning understanding among their host as a threat to the Jews. They saw that Jews embracing race was not going to be good for the Jews in the long run. By the time National Socialism rose to power in Germany, the Jews had come to the consensus that race was definitely bad for the Jews, and they were throwing all their efforts into an idea, a movement that would eventually be called anti-racism. Anti-racism is a Jewish construct, though they have tried to generalize it and otherwise obscure this fact. As many whites are beginning to realize, anti-racism is really just anti-whiteism. It is a movement, a perverse way of thinking about race that doesn't actually abolish the idea of race, but simply inverts white consciousness, making white bad and non-white good. It was inspired and continues to be led and driven by Jews who think that this is what's best for the Jews.